everyone. My name is Umair.
Hey, it's Angie here.
Today we're chatting with Paul Kershaw about a campaign that we just launched today. The idea is that we're getting elected officials across the country to pledge to become generational fairness champions. Me and Angie are going to chat with Paul about what this means. All right, Angie, you want to take it away?
Sure. So thanks for letting me crash this party with you guys. I just want to hear all about this great campaign that's just launched. Can we just even start from the beginning, Paul? What's the purpose? What are we trying to achieve here?
Well, I think this is a great question. I'm quite excited about this particular campaign because we've often gone to government decision makers federally and provincially. People have heard us talk about that in previous episodes of the podcast. But often we've done it specifically on an issue like housing or on childcare or on the climate change, etc. All critical intergenerational issues facing younger Canadians. But less often have we actually gone and framed the conversation around what Gen Squeeze is really all about, you know, fixing this broken intergenerational system so that we're going to invest in well-being from the early years onward. And this campaign is trying to get our elected officials to pledge to like, yeah, I get why fixing that broken generational system matters. And so I commit to be a Gen Fairness champion. And I'm really excited about bringing the level of discourse up to that more general conversation. I think Canada's got good at talking about systemic racism, and now we need to act on it. Same with systemic classism and sexism and colonialism, etc. We haven't been so good at acknowledging that we have this dysfunctional generational system. And so the campaign aims to put that more on the political radar with our elected officials of all party stripes.
So let's say one of the elected officials becomes a champion. How might that change what you see from them or how they talk or what they focus on?
I mean, we had some success and we have more work to do on the housing, on the family policy, on the climate change policy. But we're not going to make more success or as much success as we're not going to achieve as much success as we need if we're not having our elected decision makers see that there's a root tension that links all of them, that there's this tendency in Canadian society for us to sort of cannibalize all the good stuff from systems and leave less of it behind for those who are following, whether it's the atmosphere's scarce capacity to absorb carbon that we're leaving so little of that behind, or the housing system's ability to produce affordability because we're taking out so much wealth, or you think about budgets that are disproportionately investing later in the life course, not investing enough in younger people. So that's a common, you know, people would refer to that almost as tragedy of the commons. This is a common root cause. And rather than talking about the outcome of that root cause in different policy areas, I think we're going to make more progress in those different policy areas if we start to get to the root cause and talk about it. And so having someone pledge to be a generational fairness champion in the world of politics means we're more likely to start having them say, oh, I hadn't realized we hadn't been investing fairly in young and old alike. Oh, I see why it's important to invest even more in trying to prevent illness than actually what we put into treating it after the fact. Oh, I see why, specifically around housing, it's got to be housing for homes, not as an investment strategy. Oh my God, are we really leaving so much more government debt for young people than we did just a few decades ago? And lastly, oh my God, of course we need to leave our climate better, in a better place for future generations, because we've really trashed it of late. I think that's what we're aiming for.
Yeah, like if they were to put their generational glasses on and just kind of as they're thinking through policy or assessing priorities or talking to people, it's through a lens of generational fairness.
I think one of the things Gen Squeeze has done reasonably well in trying to facilitate dialogue with the Canadian public is we've been trying to do this dot connecting, have people see the connection between what's going on in housing and what's going on in climate, what's going on in family policy, what's going on in our budgets more generally, and seeing like, oh, there is this common issue there. I don't think we've been as strong at doing that in the world of politics, because when you meet with politicians, you got like 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, maybe a half hour meeting if you're like lucky. And so I think right now we're going to say, we're going to just prioritize the short time we have to bring people to see the to connect the dots, to put on, in your language, those generational glasses so that we can see that common problem, you know, wherever we turn our gaze.
The pledge itself, let's say, you know, I am an elected official, I'm a federal MP, and Jen Squeeze comes to me and says, you know, we want you to take this pledge. So what does that entail? Are we asking people to adopt the policy recommendations that we've come up with, or is this more of a general kind of thing? Like, what is it that we're really asking them?
This specific campaign asks people to embrace the language specifically of being a generational fairness champion. So that's the first thing one needs to commit to, engaging with that label and embracing it with enthusiasm. It's a really safe thing. It's like mom and apple pie. Who doesn't want generational fairness? And then we do have, you know, people are like, what does that mean? And so we have these five bullet points. I just summarized them a moment ago. Invest fairly in young and old alike. Invest more in preventing illness than treating it. Prioritize housing for homes first, investment second, reduce government debts, and leave the planet in a better place for future generations. We're asking people to commit to those goals. Now, there is likely to be disagreement about the policy tools to use and prioritize to achieve those goals. And that's okay. We can continue to have that conversation. We're not asking people, we're not asking politicians to commit to specific policy tools when becoming Gen Fairness champions. Rather, we're wanting them to say, ah, yeah, when I'm thinking about where I'm wanting to take this country or this province, I know that the part of the beach, this better place that I want to get to, where it's warm and comfortable and the breeze is cooling and the water is enticing, it's going to include a commitment to Canada working for all generations. And so that's the level at which we're casting this particular, pledge. And we do so with the intention of making it, as a result, attractive across party lines. And, you know, I want to share at some point, I hope, some factoids that, you know, give rise to why we identified these five bullet points. And then simultaneously, I think we could talk about how, you know, this is something that, you know, conservatives are going to like, liberals are going to like, NDP are going to like, and Greens are going to like, and try and, you know, contribute to this cross-party convergence around, oh yeah, we need to do something about generational fairness, just like you have cross-party convergence right now, like, hey, we need to do things about medical care specifically. You know, you've increasingly got cross-party convergence around climate change, and so that matters for signaling that Canadian culture has created enough political cover for politicians of all stripes to start acting on critical issues, the lack of generational fairness being one of them, because we see it manifesting itself in unaffordable housing, unaffordable childcare, larger government debts, larger environmental debts, etc.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if we can get into what you just hinted at, Paul, about why this will be something that all parties can embrace. You know, we want this to be an issue that is nonpartisan in the way that we have something like healthcare or, let's say, Indigenous rights. I mean, you know, everyone would proclaim that these are things that they're concerned with. And so we want to transform our political culture where everyone says that they believe in intergenerational fairness, and then we can figure out, okay, so what are we trying to do about it? And everyone will have disagreements about how exactly we bring that about. Yes. Yeah, so then why do you think that across the political spectrum that this will be something that people want to pledge to?
Yeah, great. And let me just reinforce sort of the tactical decision that you were alluding to there. I mean, in order to win policy change, we both need to convince elected officials about the importance of the goal first, and then you can have conversations about, well, what are the best policy tools to help us achieve that goal? And so with this campaign, I think Jen Squeeze is conceding and wanting to overcome the fact that there's still work to do to actually achieve progress amongst the elected officials that they see the goal of generational fairness being important. And I think we had this really, really important political moment when our deputy prime minister and finance minister, Chrystia Freeland, recently acknowledged, for instance, that the housing system actually does represent an intergenerational injustice. She used, quote, intergenerational injustice. For me, that was such an important signal that our work at Gen Squeeze is contributing to the necessary culture shift generally in Canada and in the world of politics to start framing it that way. And given that opening that was created with that very choice of words by the deputy prime minister, we're not going to say, okay, we want to affirm that choice. We want to see that spread throughout the world of politics, federally and provincially, regardless regardless of the party stripes running those governments. So that's the tactical decision in the moment at hand. And then the list of five things, you know, invest fairly in young and old alike, invest more in preventing illness rather than treating it, prioritize homes first as opposed to investments, reduce government debts and leave the planet better off than we found it. These are things that, you know, are going to cut across party lines. So, you know, historically conservative parties, for instance, have often really wanted to prioritize fiscal responsibility and not running government deficits. I would say conservatives have strayed from that more recently, but that's going to be the kind of language that really does resonate with that constituency. I don't think there's a party out there that's opposed to the idea conceptually of investing in young and old alike. I just don't think most parties realize that from coast to coast to coast, we've been, over the last several decades, increasing investment in those over 65 four times faster than we've been increasing spending on those under 45. So in other words, we've been increasing spending on retirees much more so than we've been investing in the generation raising young kids. And implicated in that is our whole approach to health. And we're at a moment right now where you've got premiers meeting saying, you know, our current approach to medical care is broken. You know, you have people of different kind of party stripes using that language. And I think we have to recognize it's not just what's happening with the resources going into emergency rooms or what have you in the illness treatment service sector. We have to recognize that we actually health begins not with medical care, but where we're born, grow, live, work, and age, those conditions. We got that. We were so reminded of that during the pandemic because you were much more likely to experience and fall ill with COVID, you know, depending on where you worked, the quality of your housing, what was your income, etc. And so we have to remember that social policy is actually what so often what promotes health and well-being. And when we don't do that well, we have then increased demand for illness treatment. And that goes hand in hand also with an aging population, because biologically, of course, we're going to more often need medical care when we're older. And so I think we're at a moment where this idea of, like, we're going to partly fix the medical care system and the challenges we're facing by getting a better balance of investing to promote well-being and prevent illness, as opposed to just investing in treating illness after the fact. The housing issue across the country now, you know, whether it's the NDP government in BC, you know, saying we have a housing crisis, or you've got the Conservative Party in Ontario saying we have a housing crisis there, or you have the Liberals federally. So I just nailed all the big three parties. They're worried about what's going on with housing. And I think we're at this moment, especially since the rise in interest rates have started to put a dampening influence on the escalation of home prices, we have an opportunity for people not to be entirely freaking out by the possibility that we don't want to grow our economy by growing the cost of major cost of living, housing, out of reach for what local earnings pay. And lastly, well, certainly the Green parties will be celebrating our commitments to leaving the planet a better place for future generations and younger Canadians today. But you can just see in the voters' guide work that we've done in the Ontario, the federal, and the BC elections of late that there is cross-party convergence on this. There will be disagreements about how fast we need to do it, what are the right tools, but it, I think, has become a mom and apple pie issue at the conceptual level that climate change is frightening. It is here right now. We are experiencing it from coast to coast to coast and around the world, and it is literally putting in jeopardy. This is the downer moment of the talk. It's putting in jeopardy the very conditions that younger and future generations need for their health and for their financial security. Sorry about the downer moment.
I have some questions just about, you've summarized the five focus areas, and lots of them are ones that we see in the media a lot. And so, you know, the healthcare one, the housing one, the climate change one, or you know, leaving the planet in a better place. I just wanted to clarify, so if somebody's committing to investing fairly in young and old alike, what does that mean? Is that, you know, at sort of adding up the bill and on, you know, on balance, we want to make sure the scales are even? Is that what that means?
Yeah, you know, with this particular campaign, we have used this language, invest fairly in young and old alike, as the objective. We haven't specified what precisely the metric is to know when we've achieved that. And to be clear, at Gen Squeeze, we actually don't think investing fairly in young and old alike means we're going to invest as much in younger people as we do in those who are over 65. Indeed, we have long shown since we started Generation Squeeze that every year we're spending over $30,000 a year per person over 65 and less than $13,000 a year per person under 45. And generally, there's going to remain a large gap. We've talked about nudging younger people's investments up from, like, you know, 12 to 13 to 14 in that general range to 15. That's people are like, oh, that might not be enough. We can quibble about how much we need to push up the investments per younger person, but it is a biological reality that we're going to need more of our medical care when we are older. And it's a biological reality that I don't want my mom to have to work until her last breath. I want her to enjoy a financially secure retirement. So our public policy is going to lean towards investing more in Social Security or old age security, I should say, pension security, and to medical care, which we're going to use later on. It's just the urgency with which we continue to grow those parts of our systems for retirees by comparison with the urgency that we bring to investing in younger Canadians, the generation raising young kids, and do so in ways that prevent illness and foster well-being. We need to bring as much urgency to that. And right now, just go and turn on the news and see what public policy issues are we talking about. Coming out of the pandemic, it's not a surprise that we have a dialogue oriented around what's happened in our healthcare system and the strains that have gone there as people have been adapting for 2 years of the pandemic and stretching our human resources there, nurses, doctors, other medical professionals. But if that consumes all of the oxygen of our social policy discourse, we will miss the forest for the trees and we will fail to see the root cause of accelerated illness in our society and accelerated demand for medical care is that we're not preventing problems. We're not recognizing that poverty reduction is healthcare, that childcare promotes health, that improving housing affordability promotes health, fighting climate change promotes health. If we don't see those things and invest in those ways, we will continue to have accelerated demand in our emergency rooms with our family doctors, etc. And we have to really grapple with the reality that we never did ask our aging population to pay enough taxes during their working lives to cover the cost of the medical care they now want to use when they're getting older. It's not their fault as individuals. They acted in good faith, they played by the rules of the day, and they paid the taxes according to what our governments asked. But our governments were not recognizing, even though they had this information, they weren't bold enough to start saying we need to increase taxes around things related to medical care to anticipate the pressures that will come with an aging population. Let me just remind people of some analyses that we've done with regards to taxation in Canada. And the punchlines are that actually our tax rates are lower today by comparison with when baby boomers started out as young adults, in the range of like 10 to 12%, depending on what income bracket someone is. All the while, the amount of money that we're collecting and allocating to medical care and old age security is going up dramatically. And so it turns out that every young adult today is paying approximately 50% more for the medical care used by each retiree today by comparison with when boomers started out. So young people today paying 50% more towards medical care for retirees compared to what boomers paid for retirees when they were young. Just think about that. That's a big increase in what today's aging population is expecting of younger people. But because Canada also has this cultural context of ignoring that age tension and generally saying, you know, please win my vote, but don't expect, you know, by offering me more, but I'm not sure I want to pay more taxes, we run into this problem where we're running large deficits, which grows our debt, and then we have constraints in our big public services. Medical care is such a powerful one. It's such a huge institution. It's about 50% of most provincial budgets. They're particularly good at articulating the problems in their system, and good on them for being good at it. But because they're so good at it, they often can crowd out the ability of the childcare movement or the housing movement or the poverty reduction movement or the climate movement to actually articulate how their systems are actually even often less invested in, more having more challenges. And that's the kind of balance right now that we really need to strike.
I see. So if our hope is that an elected official keeps a generation, I keep using, I don't know why I'm using like accessories as metaphors today, but I was going to say the generational hat on. Then the hope is that they're keeping all the issues in some kind of balance, like having in the front of their mind the trade-offs. So if we focus entirely all of our efforts, investments, brain work into housing, for example, then we might be leaving these other areas in some kind of deficit. But I just wonder if I'm, like, what do I gain as an elected official if I say, hey, I'm a gen fairness champion?
Yeah, great question. I think that what's driving us is thinking as follows. Politicians need a few things in order to be successful. You know, during elections, they need enough votes to win their seats and be the party with the majority of power. Outside of elections, they need to be seen to be doing right so that they're more likely to get reelected. This kind of pledge we are positioning is a way for people to portray themselves as doing right and doing so in a public way, and where Gen Squeeze can use some of the person power that we have in our network to affirm that we think, ah, it's great when an elected official is saying that they'll take the pledge. It's a problem when they don't. And so it's those optics of being seen to be doing right, and doing right for a constituency, a large constituency. Younger Canadians now have the potential to be a very big voting bloc, although we don't exercise that potential as much as we might like. And I think we were, Angie, when we were, you and I were last on a episode together, we were kind of on the councillor's sofa lamenting voter turnout rates in Ontario. Mm-hmm. But that is, I think, the logic behind what's in the interest of politicians being viewed by the public to be doing right. And then to use your Gen Squeeze bling ideas, so it's the Gen Squeeze or the generational fairness hat or the generational fairness glasses that people are putting on. I think we're saying if enough elected officials embrace the generational lens, then they are more likely to see that this broken generational system is a root cause to many other problems they're already trying to fight as elected officials, whether that's housing, climate change, childcare policy, medical care issues, government deficits, etc. Because they will be now having a lens that helps them connect the dots in ways that they haven't seen before. So that's kind of our if-then-because logic behind why this tactic is likely to be useful at this moment. And I think it's also a really big test for Generation Squeeze as a movement. I think, you know, I often talk with colleagues, you know, I think we're Gen Squeeze 3.0 right now. We've been doing this for a decade. And I think that we haven't been as bold in previous versions of Gen Squeeze of just saying, you know, the problem is a lack of generational fairness. You need to acknowledge. If you don't get that, we're here to help you understand what that means, and we'll walk you through the details of why we have these five bullet points we're wanting you to commit to. We'll show you the evidence about how things have changed and been made worse for younger Canadians and future generations. But we're not going to make enough progress on all the other manifestations of the broken system if we don't get you understanding the root cause. And if we can't live up to that, if we can't achieve that as Gen Squeeze, then our constituency has reasons to be annoyed with us, and or we need to ask our constituency to help us spread the message, spread the evidence more effectively going forward.
So if I may introduce a non-accessory version of a metaphor.
No, we need consistency in the session, Umair. No, I'm kidding.
Well, no, actually, I don't know if I have a metaphor so much as... in just thinking about, you know, intergenerational fairness, or even like passing the torch along from one generation to another, you know, so I have a toddler and he's almost 2 years old. And it's just fascinating to me that right now, in many ways, the core sort of personality that he will have is being formed, right? Cognitively, emotionally. And yet he's not going to have a recollection of this time. And so he's going to be a grown man someday, and he's going to have all sorts of characteristics, good and bad. And many of them are going to be traced back to his life as a baby and a toddler. And he's just, you know, I may have a better sense of that than he does. And I think in a somewhat similar way, human beings are just not conscious of the way in which one generation leaves things for the next one. This kind of passing on the torch just sort of happens. And historically, it's happened and it's been fine. We don't need to be conscious, right? Because we don't have an industrial society that's polluting the atmosphere. And so it's been okay. So we've just tended to be blind. And I would say, I mean, Paul, you've said that, you know, Chrystia Freeland, for instance, has pointed out that housing in this country is it's an issue of intergenerational unfairness, right? So in that kind of way, we can say, okay, there's progress here. But really, on a system-wide level, like, they're just, we don't have this awareness. We don't have this understanding that this is even something that we need to be thinking about. And I hope that that's what we're trying to contribute to with a campaign like this.
What you said resonates so much with my experience as well. So, you know, my husband and I, we've known Paul for a long time. We've had this language of intergenerational fairness and just thinking about that a lot. And whenever we've talked to our families about it, of our parents' generation, the response is usually, we were doing the best we could. Like, we thought we were doing right by our families. And I believe them, and I know that to be true. They were doing their best. And I think that I'm also doing the best I have two kids, and I think I'm doing the best as well. And maybe, you know, 30 years from now, when they're tallying things up, it's like, oh no, you guys really messed up. I'll be in the same hot spot. And I really like the way that you framed kind of what we would hope this campaign contributes to, is like really paying a lot more attention to our actions, how we treat each other, how we care for and are willing to, you know, make decisions that have a lot more people in mind, not just our friends and family, but strangers as well, because everything we're doing does make some small contribution to the next generation. And we need to be a lot more deliberate and mindful, I think, about potential consequences.
Yeah, what you sort of said maybe will allow me to clarify what I was going on about when I was talking about parenthood. Because I've realized that, like, as a parent, I'm mostly just doing what my parents did, right? Or, like, that's sort of where my instincts as a parent come from. And a lot of that was fine. But I'm realizing, like, okay, maybe some of it isn't okay. And I should be more conscious of what my instincts are so that I can actively intervene when I need to, right? So to say, okay, actually, no, you know what, Umair, maybe you don't need to do this in that particular way. And so that's, I guess, if we're trying to use that as a frame for talking about the intergenerational system more broadly. Yeah, I don't know how that sounds to you, Paul.
Well, I think both of your observations remind us about themes that Angie and I emphasized in the early episodes of the Hard Truths podcast, where we observed that the tendency to think intergenerationally does factor in our families quite regularly, I would say. I mean, I think that your thoughts right now about your lovely 2-year-old son is, you know, those thoughts are signaling that you're conscious about, you know, the responsibilities you have to him. And the legacy you want to leave and the opportunities you want to create. And so you're planning for him as you're planning for yourself and your partner, and you're planning for your aging parents. And you're thinking across generations at the family level. Angie's saying the same thing. And at the same time, you're also recognizing that as parents and citizens, that it's one thing to try and influence what's happening inside your own home with your own kids. It's another thing to try and influence the systems around you that shape so many of the outcomes that are available to your home and available to your neighborhood and your community and so on. And so I think that's why even when Jen Squeeze is trying to share this hard truth with some of our aging parents and grandparents and other family members, and it's a hard truth to hear that maybe the legacy being left behind isn't quite as strong as they would have liked, nor those inheriting it would like, we have to acknowledge the kind of the good, like Angie's like, we did the best we could. And I think we can go further to say that most people were acting within the system according to the rules that the system was imposing for them or creating for them. And I think we can acknowledge that. And then we can also say, but on your watch, this system was sustained. On your watch, there were reasons to question the system. And did we do enough as citizens to try and shape the systems to be contributing to intergenerational fairness in the three ways that Angie and I have talked about in the past. Like, have we been good stewards protecting what's so sacred, like a stable climate, like a good home, like a healthy childhood? Have we been showing reciprocity between generations? Have we been ensuring that we are not using so much right now and leaving unpaid bills for those who follow? Have we been treating those who follow us like we would have wanted to be treated? And are we planning for young and old alike, not just in our families around our intergenerational dining table, but in our world of politics? And so, you know, we've talked in previous episodes about bringing that intergenerational love in the family into the world of politics. I know it sounds hokey, but maybe at its most fundamental level, that's what this Gen Fairness Champion pledge is all about. Do you pledge to bring the intergenerational love from our family dynamics into our political dynamics?
I don't think it's hokey at all. I think it's very purposeful.
Yeah, I think it clarifies too what, like, elected officials are largely just like any of us, like in the sense of, oh, okay, if I pledge myself as a champion, what does this mean? And I don't really know how to interpret that into my work. But if it really is, okay, here's a place to start. Think about the sense of responsibility that you have towards your family and your friends, your inner circle, and extend that outwards. You know, this whole idea about citizenry could be an entire episode in itself, because we should really examine what it means to be a citizen right here and now in Canada, 2022. Anyways, but I think that's actually really helpful, Paul, to go from, okay, just think about your thinking process, your feelings, your commitments inside, and extend that outwards. If you were a politician, what would that look like? If you were a citizen, what would that look like?
Yeah. And the 4-year election timelines that are so prominent in the world of politics mitigate against thinking in those intergenerational ways. They're much more the short term and the now. And so we have to have some sympathy for the constraints within which elected officials work in the real politics of their day-to-day lives. And we as citizens have to make it safe for them to actually think across generations. We have to make that politically safe. That's why a group like Jen Squeeze says we're in the business of rejuvenating democracy, and we will counter, when possible, the idea that people think politics is broken, or that politics is something we should be pessimistic about or make jokes about routinely, because, as we've said in the past, we can't solve these big systemic problems individually most of the time. We only solve them by changing the policies that sustain them over time. And so we can be frustrated with our elected officials at key moments. And at those key moments, before we let our frustration take too strong a hold on our heart and our heads, we should ask ourselves, you know, how are we and other citizens creating the political context in which it defines what's safe for politicians to do? And another way of thinking about this is another effort for Jen Squeeze to signal to the world of politics that we've got a constituency that wants to make it safe for you to think longer term, to think across generations, to get it right for young and old alike and those who are following our footsteps, to really think about legacy and the legacy that you're leaving as elected officials and that we're collectively leaving as parents and grandparents and as citizens and neighbors.
Well, I want to ask a question about that cynicism that you mentioned, because I think it's relevant. So politicians, as we've said, are just like regular people. We're all complicated and we all try our best. But we also know that, as you've hinted at, Paul, the constraints that politics takes place within, there's certain things that end up winning out. And one of the things that we see repeatedly is that politicians have a very relatively easy time taking, you know, making pledges and promises that then go on to be renounced or forgotten, shoved under the rug somewhere.
Like 2015 was going to be the last first past the post election in our country, something like that.
Yes, but you know, that's just one example, and a very prominent one. But so I guess my question is, you know, okay, so we're getting people to take this pledge. How will we ensure that that has, you know, a substantive kind of impact, as opposed to just being like, oh, this is a pledge I'm taking up because it'll maybe make me look good in front of a certain constituency that may therefore vote for me?
Yeah, well, I don't suspect there's that many listeners to the Hard Truth podcast who are expecting that this particular tactic and our overall strategy to make Canada live up to its potential is going to win the day. So we might have dozens and dozens and dozens of politicians hopefully taking the pledge. And we will still have a dysfunctional intergenerational system.
Oh, no.
We will. I know. I'm sorry to concede. This isn't the be-all and end-all.
This isn't going to solve it.
So, no, I guess at this moment is where we need to have people think about, you know, the incremental steps along a broader change-making path. And I'll go back to, you know, a success story that Jen Squeeze and others can take pride in. You know, think about $10 a day childcare, where we've seen these historic investments, in particular by the federal government of late, in our budgets. And these were a long time coming. Heck, you know, I know for certain that really they have their origins in the 1970 report of the Royal Commission on the Status of Women, when we really first had in the world of politics a recommendation for a national child care system. And then, you know, over the next decades, you had many really talented leaders, and these are disproportionately women leaders from coast to coast to coast, bringing the message of child care to change people's hearts and minds. And I think about the Coalition of Child Care Advocates in BC being a particularly important group on that front, and my colleague Linnell Anderson in particular. And then, so, you know, then groups like Jen Squeeze over the last, we started like 10, 12, 15 years ago trying to like frame issues differently. And when I was first talking about childcare, I remember going on our Chorus radio station out here in BC, and I would do the talk shows, and I would talk about why we needed to invest substantially in childcare, and I'd have people call and say, well, we didn't have childcare back in the day. Why do young people need it now? Gosh, they're just so whiny. Can't they just work hard? And if they can't afford to have kids, don't have the kids. So that was sort of a dominant framing of the day, and or that government couldn't afford it. And so we had to, you know, go and resist those dominant cultural assumptions, which is what led to Jen Squeeze framing childcare as $10 a day, making that seem affordable to people, and ensuring that we needed to make childcare affordable, because right now it's costing another rent or mortgage-sized payment as home prices were skyrocketing, or twice university tuition as student debt was growing. And that framing, and it was embraced by others over time, it actually slowly but surely changed hearts and minds, and made it possible so that when the federal government actually was convinced by movements, you know, led by Child Care Now, but they needed a rationale to justify it to Canadians, they embraced the framing that a group like Jen Squeeze had been developing and working with others to spread. And so I think that this pledge, bringing it to today around a generational fairness champion, and I pledge to be one in the world of politics, is yet another tactic by which we are working to change what people believe are the major problems of the day, what are their major sources of those problems, and what are the solutions. And if anyone's ever read the details in the Jen Squeeze website, you'll know that as we're trying to change these big systems to fix what's broken about them, we think we're in the business of drawing people's attention to the evidence, having them make meaning of the evidence in light of their own values in order to shape broader public opinion, frame Canadians' beliefs generally about problems and solutions, and especially frame those beliefs in the world of politics so that we can set an agenda. And this pledge starts to hint at that agenda. I've laid out those five things. Invest fairly in young and old alike. Invest in preventing illness as much as we treat it. Make sure housing is for homes, not just investments. Don't leave so many large debts. You know, have a proud climate legacy. We've really urgently got to respond. That becomes the goals and an agenda around which we build a movement and a coalition. And the larger the coalition, the greater power we have to influence the world of politics. So that's what the pledge does. That was a really long answer, but it is about reframing our hearts and minds' assumptions about what are the big problems, what are their root causes, and where do the solutions lie. That's how this can help. But tomorrow, after people, you know, take the pledge, we'll still have the hard work of taking that framing and then making that lead to more openness to changing current policies, which are propping up the status quo and the dysfunctional generational system.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Jen Squeeze's Hard Truths podcast. If you've got thoughts about what you heard, let us know by writing to info@jensqueeze.ca. Also, please consider rating and reviewing the podcast. Thanks again for tuning in. We'll see you again soon.